KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. When you think about music in the Northwest, is hip-hop the first thing that comes to your mind? Well, if not, maybe it should be. We're going to trace our region's hip-hop history. That's later this hour. First, this fall, President Obama will choose a new chair for the Federal Reserve. The nominee will replace two-term Fed chair Ben Bernanke. Last week, the president mentioned two people he's considering for the job, former Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers and Janet Yellen, who's the Fed's current vice chair. Some critics say the president needs to cast his net a bit wider. What does the Fed chair do, and what will the president's selection mean to the American economy? John Nichols joins me now. He's Washington correspondent for The Nation. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Marcy. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, you too. Can you explain why it matters to me, who chairs the Federal Reserve?
Well, it matters to you because you're a sharp, insightful person who covers the affairs of the day. It matters to everybody else because this is the most important selection President Obama will make, aside from perhaps a Supreme Court justice. The only reason I say that is because, as with a Supreme Court justice, this selection will almost certainly serve beyond President Obama's term. So this person, just as a Supreme Court justice defines the law of the land, the Fed chair will define much, if not all, of the economy, not just during the remainder of President Obama's term, but well into the next president's term.
What exactly does the Fed chair do?
Well, imagine the Fed chair as something very similar to the person who controls a waterworks. And the Fed chair is the person who could turn the water on or turn it off. They can ease the flow of money, or they can slow it down. They can focus that flow of money toward creating jobs, toward revitalizing communities, or towards protecting the bottom lines of banks and big corporations, or they can do a little bit of both. But the bottom line is the Fed chair, in combination with the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors, it is a group of people, but the chair being the definitional figure, they have immense power granted them by Congress to essentially guide not just the day-to-day affairs, but the long-term arc of the U.S. economy.
So I mentioned two names that the president has mentioned as well. Let's start with this first nominee, Larry Summers, who you called the ultimate predictable insider. Who is he, and why is he ultimately predictable?
Most people know Larry Summers' name. He was Secretary of Treasury for a while, and he's held just about every other kind of insider, economic advisor, economic counselor for the last two Democratic presidents, both President Clinton and now President Obama. He's very much a definitional figure in what is referred to as neoliberal economics, and I don't want to get too arcane here, but the basic idea is that Larry Summers is a guy who really believes in using the power of the Fed to enrich Wall Street, to enrich big banks, not purely because he loves Wall Street and big banks, but because he believes in it, that then, you know, churns out and strengthens the economy. So he has a certain vision, and he's also been a controversial figure because he was in charge of Harvard, and when he was at Harvard, he said some very controversial things about women that ultimately got him in a lot of trouble. and he is, to be honest, Larry Summers is, by all accounts, an incredibly brilliant figure. But he is incredibly outspoken, incredibly controversial, and it isn't just what he said about women. In the past, he said things about development in Africa and other issues that have stirred an immense amount of controversy. So unlike most economists, he's somebody who makes headlines.
Well, the other figure that's been mentioned doesn't seem to make as many headlines. I don't know as much about Janet Yellen. In fact, didn't really even know her name until this year.
isn't that, well, they are almost polar opposites, you know, just as Summers makes every headline, even when he isn't trying. Yellen is very much a career economist in the public sector. She is the vice chair of the board of governors of the Fed, so she's within the Fed already. She is very, very respected by a lot of, to be quite blunt with you, more progressive economists, and also by, frankly, a lot of women who have said two things. One, they're very uncomfortable with Summers. Mm-hmm. And two, that Yellen, it's not just that she's a woman. She is highly qualified. No one would doubt her qualifications. And that it is time that this definitional economic position no longer go to the predictable die. And so there is some advocacy there. But not, I want to emphasize, that is not, you know, some sort of, oh, we think Yellen should go up because she's a woman. It is very much underpinned by an awfully lot of folks, men and women, saying we think she should go up because she is a highly qualified individual who happens to be a woman. And it's been too long with too many men in these positions.
We're talking with John Nichols, who's Washington correspondent for The Nation. Two of Congress's more, progressive figures, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, I guess that's the best way to describe those two, would like to see the president maybe come up with some names that are even beyond Janet Yellen when it comes to what you call a somewhat more progressive point of view.
Absolutely. And this is an important thing to understand. In the United States today, our economic discussions are very, very narrow. My libertarian friends don't like that because they think it's far too strong government. My progressive friends on the left, don't like it because they think it's far too pro-Wall Street. The fact of the matter is they're both sort of right. We've had a situation where we've used a lot of the power of government to back up banks, to back up very big corporations, with an eye toward creating a certain kind of economy. There are progressive figures in the Senate, folks like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who are saying, look, that's ridiculous. The Fed has so much power, so much authority to do more than just, you know, get money over to the banks or help the banks out. It also has a mandate defined more than 40 years ago to establish and implement policies to create the fullest possible employment in the United States, to do real development of our communities, especially inner cities and low-income areas. And so what Sanders and Warren are saying is, look, we've got to get a different kind of vision into this position. And so they're arguing that instead of a predictable insider, and obviously Summers being the most predictable insider, but Yellen also being somebody who comes from the inside. Mm-hmm. They're saying, let's look elsewhere. Let's look at somebody like Nobel Economics Prize winner Joseph Stiglitz, who has been an advisor to world leaders, who's a very respected economist, but who says that we ought to be using the power of the Fed much more to benefit the whole of the American people, not just, you know, a handful of business institutions. Or let's look at a Robert Reich, the former Secretary of Labor, a highly regarded economic thinker in this country, far beyond his political life. He's been an academic and been in many, many key settings and has been highly critical of the way that the Fed has operated up to this point. Essentially, they're arguing for shaking it up. I've got to be honest with you, Marcy. The likelihood that the Fed gets shaken up is a little slim. But in a sense, what they're trying to do is extend and open up a dialogue about the power of the Fed.
Well, I was going to ask, how likely is the president to be swayed by voices from any of these political directions, left, right, center, you name it?
Well, I agree with you. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that the number one thing that we ought to be doing, and Warren and Sanders have done this, is to try and get people a lot more educated about the Fed, about its immense power. And so while they have suggested other names, and I think that in part that's because they really, or especially Sanders, I'd say Sanders is the one suggesting other names, in part because they really do want alternative visions there, but also to open up this dialogue. Sanders and Warren have also done something else. They have written a list of questions that any Fed nominee should answer, and they're very pointed about the vision and direction of the Fed. All of this is being done to say that the economic policy of the United States ought not happen behind closed doors or in our name, but without our informed consent. It ought to be something that we, the people, have a lot more knowledge of and engagement with. And so I appreciate what they're trying to do to open this dialogue up.
When is the president scheduled to announce his nominee for this job?
President Obama says that he will announce his pick sometime this fall. Now, that's because the current head of the Fed, Ben Bernanke, will step down at some point in the relatively near future. He has till early next year, so he's got a little bit of time. But the Fed is such a powerful agency, such an important agency, frankly, whether we like it or not, that you can't really leave the Fed chair open and you can't have it subject to a lot of controversy. And so what the president will do is make a nomination sometime, I would say relatively early in the fall, and then that nominee will have to be vetted by the Senate. And so that's why the president's giving it a little bit of lead time, so that if there is any debate in the Senate, it can sort out in time for when Bernanke steps down.
A full Senate approval is required?
Yeah. It's a weird thing. Technically, the Fed is an extension of the federal government. It's something that was created a long time ago, better part of 100 years ago. And the idea is that at some, basic level, the Fed still has to respond to advice and consent of the Senate. Fed chairs have to come and testify before congressional committees, things of that nature. But the truth of the matter is, once you're approved as the chairman of the Fed, you become a super powerful figure, very much like, different in many ways, but at some fundamental level, like a Supreme Court justice, mm-hmm. in that you're there for, admittedly, the Fed chair, not a permanent appointment. It's a tenure. But bottom line is, once you're in there, you're very powerful and you're very, very hard to crack down on. So the key period here is not so much the president's appointment, but it's that Senate oversight.
Well, John Nichols, thank you for making the Federal Reserve a fascinating intrigue subject.
It is very. This is the real intrigue of power.
John Nichols is Washington correspondent for The Nation. Great talking with you.
A pleasure, Marcy. Take care.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Do you love karaoke? Or maybe you just don't get karaoke. Let us know by calling our feedback line, 206-221-3663. That's 206-221-3663. We'll talk about all things karaoke this afternoon at 12:40.
Every August, it's the same thing. Zucchini, lots of zucchini, sprawling all over the garden. Cooks get tired of all that squash.
You need to take your vegetable peeler and go outside to that garden and show the zucchini who's boss.
Some delicious ways to combat zucchini fatigue later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered beginning this afternoon at 2 o'clock on KUOW 94.9. I'm Jack Walters. Good morning. Thanks for joining us. 70 degrees in Seattle, a projected high today in the mid-70s, mostly cloudy this afternoon, a 40% chance of rain, kind of unusual in August to get this kind of rain. Tonight's low around 60, mostly cloudy with a 30% chance of showers.
Nope. First memories of Seattle hip-hop. I remember the sit and spin. Listen to Rap Attack, listen to Nasty Nas on Rap Attack. Silver Shadow D, Be Mellow. That Do the Math. Hit me in my dome.
Poetry experience, that's where I really started writing.
Was rock candy. Many cyphers, many battles, many sidewalks. Held underground parties in Langston Hughes. Township.
Now when I say 2-0, you say, nah, you know the rest. This is our scene, our music, our movement, the history lives through us. I write to the beat and let life play the guitar strings. Despite the drama, there's respect.
Smack Lamore and Ryan Lewis from KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. I happened to glance up at one of our newsroom TV monitors this morning, and who did I see on a Good Morning America promo? It was Mac Lamore in an oversized fur coat. Mac Lamore, also on the cover of Rolling Stone this week. He's Seattle's current hip-hop king, but hip-hop goes way back in this city. According to History Link Online, August 17th, 1984, marked the first breakout mainstream hip-hop show here. It was at the Exhibition Hall at Seattle Center. So it's fitting almost 30 years to the day later that we take a look back at Seattle's hip-hop history. In the studio with me, Dr. Dottie Aube. He is author of a book called Six in the Morning, and that's an N, Six in the Morning, West Coast Hip-Hop Music, 1987 to 1992, and the Transformation of Mainstream Culture. He also teaches at Seattle Central Community College. Thanks for coming in.
It's my pleasure.
And Dottie Aube, take us back. I'm not sure if you were here in 1984, but what was the epicenter of that hip-hop scene?
Well, I think that it kind of begins to start and it spreads. So I do this hip-hop class up at Seattle Central, right. And the majority of the kids who are taking this class are
young,
18, 19, early 20s. And so part of the difficulty is trying to give some context to how music was spreading at that time. If your reference point is file sharing and things like Napster, even if these people are old enough to remember Napster, which was seemingly so long ago, about the spread of music, it's a little difficult to explain if you weren't there. But the idea of music traveling around, I ran into it as a 9-year-old, being taken to a record store, Dirt Cheap Records. It used to be right on the corner of 22nd and Union.
Mm-hmm.
Building's not even there anymore, but I'm walking around the record store. I'm 9 years old. He says, pick any record you want. Okay, so I'm walking around and I see this kind of interesting looking colorful logo design on a record jacket, and I'm 9 years old, so I'm thinking about candy. This is literally the truth. I'm thinking about candy, so I'm like, this is the one I want. We go up to the cash register, and he's the guy at the register. Is like, oh, yeah, it's a hot new song out of New York. Okay. Take it home, and I kind of recognize the beat, but nobody's singing on the record. And that was something that was puzzling to me. I didn't understand what this was. But I'm attracted to it. The B-side was the 15-minute version. That record, that logo was the logo for a company called Sugar Hill Records.
Mm-hmm.
That record was Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang. It was a 12-inch single. The A-side was the radio version. The B-side is the 15-minute extended version. Within about a day and a half, I knew all the words to that 15-minute version. And so when I'm old enough to remember when there were 8-track tapes in mm-hmm. cars, 8-track, you know what I'm saying? So the emergent technology of the time was cassette tapes, you know what I'm saying? And to go along with that were the boom boxes that had the dual cassette tapes so you could dub tapes from one another. So that's really the way that music spread as far as early hip hop and, you know, kids listening to it. Ooh, I want that. I want that. Okay, I got one of those boxes. Let's go. And that's really how music traveled early on.
We're going to listen to an early Seattle hip hop group. This is the Emerald Street Boys, and some tell me that this is Seattle's first hip-hop group.
Right. Yep.
When we sing a song, people always think it's on. People wait through the night just to hear us rock the mic. Some people say quit, others say we ain't it. But they know in their heart we could tear this place apart. Another test, another new proceeding. If the rhythm never running, if you think that's an underfucking vibration. We're coming closer and closer. Now people in the place don't move this quicker. On the up and up, we've got the sweet taste. Shit, I better write on time. Number one with a rhyme. Cause the property's stopping. That's a definite sign. While you're rocking, never stopping. When you're better, listen to it. This we got something that you never should forget.
So that's a tune called The Move, the Emerald Street Boys, and Dottie Aube is with us, and we are joined by somebody that you know by one name, and I'm going to introduce him by another, Prometheus Brown, better known as MCGO of Blue Scholars, a Seattle hip-hop artist. Thank you for coming in. And we're just listening to your antecedents, the folks that preceded you. Emerald Street Boys, officially the first, Dottie Aube?
Yeah. And so talking to them and kind of doing some background research, it's so funny listening to how the attitudes around the culture evolved, because two of the guys, Captain Crunch and Sugar Bear, two of the other members of the group is Sweet J. I talked to them independently, and they both talked about how they had heard about each other. You know what I'm saying? They were rappers, but they were also dancers. So at this point, it wasn't just one person was a rapper. You know what I'm saying? It was kind of enveloping all the elements of the culture. And so they talked about how living in the CD, you know what I'm saying, a few blocks apart, they didn't necessarily know each other, but they started to hear about each other. Like, oh, there's this cat you need to go battle because he's filthy. Oh, yeah, okay. And some, it was like the old West. You know what I'm saying? You gunslingers meet up and that kind of thing. And so they eventually met and battled and whatever and found that they were good and, you know, kind of teamed up. And so they are kind of the first wave, if you want to call it that. Because after people started to hear Rapper's Delight, didn't take long at all for people to start to imitate it and try to do it themselves.
So, Gio, Dottie just told us that the first album that he ever bought, I think he was 9 years old, and he picked it because it had a nice candy-looking cover, and it was Rapper's Delight. When did you first hear hip-hop? Do you remember?
I was born in 1980 in California. Pops was in the military, so I was in Hawaii. My pops was stationed there, and my first memories were, you know, like, early Run DMC, mid 80s stuff. And at the time, I was like 5-6 years old.
Well, we're going to play a mid 80s thing right now. This is 1985. This is a guy named Anthony Ray, that some people know as Sir Mix-a-Lot, with a guy known as Nasty Ness. Mm-hmm. And the two of them hit the radio waves.
Yep.
A lot of jealous homeboys know that Ness and I will steal the show to all you freaks and your tight guests. Check out DJ Nasty Ness. He's in his dark glasses and wearing black. He destroys boys who talk that smack.
So that you hear Mix doing the rap on top of that. Ness, I think, is doing the live mix. This was from the show on K-Fox, but they brought that show to a station, the station formerly known as KCMU, KEXP. And Anthony Ray, Sir Mix-a-Lot, was the first of the sort of hip-hop stars out of Seattle. Now, do you remember him?
Yeah, that was actually my entry point right there when we moved here from Hawaii. Was randomly on a Sunday night, tuned into the radio, and it was a faint signal with a lot of static, and yep. It was Nasty Ness. I had at that point not known that he had been on the radio for that long. I had known that he was Sir Mix-a-Lot's DJ. By that time, Sir Mix-a-Lot had already gone nationwide. But it was that show on KCMU, Rap Attack, now Street Sounds, that I got introduced to local hip hop.
Now, Dottie Abe, how important was radio for the spread of Seattle's hip-hop scene?
It was very important. The funny part of it is K-Fox, this AM station, playing music. Music that is heavily based in bass influenced, and so that part is funny. But Ness actually starts out as the DJ for the Emerald Street Boys. Then he makes that transition as the DJ over on K-Fox, and he starts off with this show called Fresh Tracks on Sunday nights, and Fresh Tracks is about a half an hour of new songs, and then he would do the other half hour of a master mix, which was just him cutting and scratching all the latest songs and everything like that. And so that is, and so there's this story that Ness told me about how Sir Mix-a-Lot starts doing these parties around 83-84. Mm-hmm. Starts off at the Rainier Vista Boys and Girls Club, and then moves that over to Rotary, what's now the Rotary Boys and Girls Club, right up there off 19th in Yesler, and would pack that place every weekend. And so Ness talks about how he's hearing about it. Now he goes up there, and, you know, there's at that time, you know what I'm saying, the CD at the time was the basis of the black community in Seattle. It's not so much now, but at that time, that was the center of the black community for greater Seattle. And so Ness goes in there, and, you know, he's the only Filipino guy in there, and there's, oh, is there going to be some racial tension? But, you know, it was cool, and he's seeing how Mix-a-Lot does it and how he's controlling the crowd. And, you know, Mix-a-Lot was good. You know what I'm saying? He was good at what he did. He, you know what I'm saying? He was at the time the full package of producing his own music and cutting and scratching live and rhyming at the same time.
Well, we're going to play a little bit of an early, a 1988 piece by Mix-a-Lot, and this is about Seattle.
while she's on Broadway.
Me and Kid Sensation at home, away from home, in the black Benz limo with a cellular phone. I'm calling up the posse, it's time to get to ripping. I freaking each sunroof to keep you suckers tripping. Everybody's looking, if you're jealous, turn around. The AMG kick keeps us closer to the ground. We're getting good grip from the 50 series tires. The Alpine's bumping, but I need the volume higher, cause the 808 kick drum makes a girly stick.
We're all getting into Posse on Broadway, 1988, Sir Mix-a-Lot. And Gio, you immediately, your body just started moving to this one. What is it about that? Mix-a-Lot, it's like a really happy kind of hip-hop sound, isn't it?
That's classic record locally, nationwide, worldwide, actually. And that song, I think, says it all. I remember talking to Nasty Ness about that song and the experience of when it dropped. And he said that they had no clue that it was going to go nationwide. They thought it was a hyper-local song, just maybe it'll get some buzz locally. But turns out there's Broadways everywhere, and if it's not called Broadway, it's the equivalent in every city, and that's what made it go nationwide. And I thought about that. This was a conversation I had with Ness before I wrote any Blue Scholar song. And I think, whether consciously or subconsciously, every time I wrote something that had a lot of hyper-local references, I was like, okay, this might relate to somebody somewhere else.
Well, let's hear something from Blue Scholars with a hyper-local reference. I think this is one. This is The Ave, and this is from your first album, 2004, so 9 years old.
I be a patient man, waiting for the rain to come down. My feet touch the ground, but my head's in the clouds. I be Prometheus Brown, stealing the fire out of heaven. The setting is several city blocks off the 71 stop. I walk about the district, distracted by the decadent madness of all the undergraduate addicts. Club rats, head space, cadets, and pragmatics. One of the few places that they coexist on the planet. Whatever happens.
So that song, it's older, but it could be The Ave. You just came in off The Ave. It hasn't changed a whole lot.
Well, I think what I described in that song, what was that, 9 years ago now?
Mm-hmm.
It's still there, but I think it's intensified. Everything that's in that song is still there, but times five.
So when you think about, I'm listening to that song, comparing it to The Posse, which was, 15 years or 16 years before that. Both of you, Dadi Abe and Gio, how has the Northwest hip-hop sound evolved? Or is that particular to you, to Blue Scholars? I mean, what do you guys think?
Man, I think, And people have said it before, we've said it before, other people agree, that there really is no single sound out here. But there's a bunch of influences that have made their way to all the different artists around here. And that's partially is the isolation of Seattle from on the map geographically from the rest of the country. The fact that aside from Mix-a-Lot and Macklemore now, there hasn't really been a national... Usually you go to other big cities and they have their one or two artists that gone national, and then like it dictates the sound for the rest of the city, regardless of whether you actually make music that sounds like that. And that just hasn't happened here, for better, for worse. I think for the better, actually. There's a multitude of sounds and influences out here, and you'll hear it from one artist to the next. And the thing is, I don't think anyone's really trying to force the sound. I think once it got accepted that Seattle has a sound that is no sound, or a sound in progress.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's definitely threads. Like, if you listen to Mix-a-Lot stuff, his stuff was more upbeat, up-tempo compared to the rest of the country. I think that still survives in some way. We have seasonal changes here, so compared to the rest of the West Coast, it might be a little bit more laid back than Cali.
Well, people have talked about how hip-hop is softer here, content-wise softer, or maybe sweeter. First of all, do you agree? And second of all, how do you take that kind of comment?
Yeah, yes and no. I think the geography, weather, all those things play into it. And also the audience up here, I think if you the more you dig deep, the more you find that there's, again, if you say Seattle's soft, then you're only really scratching the surface. I dare anybody to dig deeper and they'll find that that's not true. But, it's not rocket science. The most accessible thing that goes popular, viral, is a thing that you know, the majority of the people around here can relate to. And just look at demographics around here, it's not really that hard to figure out.
Dadiabi, how does Seattle compare to the rest of the West Coast? You wrote a book about West Coast hip hop.
Well, I think that I could see, I agree with Gio, definitely, but I can see in terms of a perception, you know what I'm saying? If I think back to, so we do a unit in the hip hop class on Seattle hip hop and kind of do a little survey about listening to some different songs from different eras. What are some of the nuances you can kind of pull out of that? And if you listen back to Sir Mix-a-Lot, the Posse on Broadway song, there's a part in the song where they get into it with some people up at Dick's and my homeboy P.O.B. Cole sprayed the boy with mace. And so we're talking about Mason people when at that time, a little bit further south in California, you know what I'm saying, N.W.A. was talking about doing a little bit more than Mason people. And so if you're looking at it, kind of comparing it in that way, all right, I can see how it goes. But I also think that it also speaks to the idea of, you know, kind of hip hop at its rap music in particular at its core being talking about who you are and what it's like where you're from. And, you know what I'm saying, that song, Posse on Broadway, was kind of this first really kind of export of Seattle culture to other places around the hip hop map.
I wish I had 5 hours to talk with you about this. I don't, and I've just got to touch on the role of women in this hip hop scene. We've been playing all this music by men, and there's a duo that I really like, The Satisfaction, who are young women. But where do the women fit into all of this? Is it just a man's world?
No, there was a group called the Emerald Street Girls very early on. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So there's been a presence. This has been a presence from the beginning.
I know that there are women behind the scene, behind your scene. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, besides me, Sabzi and myself, it's pretty much all women who run things behind the scenes. And also, I mean, Hollis Monware, she's like operations director. She was on Good Morning America.
She's a mighty force.
Yeah. So, and The Satisfaction, big fans of them as well. I think the discrepancy that you see in hip hop is a reflection actually of the larger culture. I think sometimes we tend to point at microcosms and say that the problem only exists there. But the male domination in hip hop, which I do think is problematic, I think is also a reflection of male domination in the society.
And in the music industry?
In the music industry, definitely.
And so just a last question, and I'll ask you, Dadi. You know, the somebody in the 90s labeled the Seattle sound rock music. Did that ever make you mad?
No. I think that's just one perspective. I mean, I think that, you know, I've listened to enough beats from here where I could make an argument that this is a hip hop town. It may not have gotten all the widespread attention that, you know, other types of music has, but no, not at all.
Well, I want to thank both of you for coming and just cracking open the door to Seattle's hip hop history. Dr. Dadiabi is the author of Six in the Morning, a West Coast Hip Hop Music 1987 to 1992 and the Transformation of Mainstream Culture. Teaches a hip hop class at Seattle Central Community College, and sometime soon his book about Seattle hip hop is going to come out. Am I jumping the gun a little bit?
I'm working on it.
He's working.
I got to talk to Gio. Matter of fact, we have to talk.
We have to talk. Prometheus Brown, best known as MC Gio of Blue Scholars. Appreciate you coming in. We're going to leave you all with some Shabazz Palaces here on KUOW.
Talk about it, it's a show. But if you move about it, then it's a go. Yeah. Now if you're talking about it, it's a show. But if you move about it, then it's a go. Now if you're talking about it, it's a show. But if you move about it, then it's a go. Yeah. Now if you're talking about it, that's show. But if you move about it, then it's a go. Well. Dynamic electromagnetic style sensors. Golden timber circled and good only by the members. Heat sparkles, brand new options upon the spinners. Movement improving. Smooth shit, you grooving, you a winner. Aqua walking laser, talking just up in the cleanest. Upper levels, precious metal, drip your neck.
It's 1041, KUOW 94.9.
This week in This American Life, a sheriff in California has a problem. His deputies spend too much time busting small-scale pot farmers. So he devises a plan. He'll let the farmers grow their pot as long as they register with the sheriff. Pretty good, right? Bust the big guys instead. So what did his deputies think?
The sheriff is off his rocker.
Stories of people who are just trying to help. this week.
Listen for that Saturday morning at 11 a.m. on KUOW 94.9.
Join KUOW for Bumbershoot, featuring 3 days of art, comedy, and music at Seattle Center this Labor Day weekend, with artists of all genres from the band Fun to 60s rock with the Zombies. More on the events page at KUOW.org.
70 degrees in Seattle, expecting a high today in the mid-70s with some clouds this afternoon, a 40% chance of rain. Tonight's low around 60, mostly cloudy with a 30% chance of showers.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
Ah, you know what that music means. From hip-hop to our weekly look back at the golden age of radio with Katie Sewell. And hi again, Katie.
Hello.
Well, you know, I'm switching heads just a second. During radio's golden age, mystery shows were often hosted by that sinister character, you know, like who knows what the shadow knows. Characters like the Man in Black, the Whistler, and the Mysterious Traveler.
Yes, the sinister host, my favorite, one of my favorite parts of old-time radio. Today, I thought it would be fun to take a look back at who the men who played these shadowy narrators actually were and what other roles they played throughout their career.
Okay.
Did they stay on the evil side of things, or did they move on?
So who's the evilest of them all?
Well, one of the most prolific at the time was the Man in Black, who you mentioned. He was the host of the long-running mystery program Suspense. Eventually, Suspense dropped that host and just went with a normal narration. But before they did, the Man in Black was played by Joseph Kearns.
Suspense. This is the Man in Black, here again to introduce Columbia's program, Suspense.
I like how he says it, Suspense.
Yes, Joseph Kearns playing the sinister host. The Man in Black, he was a noted radio actor of the time, and he was actually a little more famous for playing Professor Moriarty opposite Basil Rathbone on the Golden Age radio adaptation of Sherlock Holmes.
Holmes, you hear that?
The door. Someone's locked the door.
He'd be locked in by mistake.
No, you're wrong. It was no mistake, my friend.
So you were behind this murder too, Professor?
Of course. Perhaps you would like to know why I had to kill Lord Canterbury.
Yes, indeed. That would be very interesting.
Good.
Moriarty, the ultimate evil character, yeah.
Yes, and he's echoey there because he's talking to them through a vent. So we know that he was very good at playing evil characters, but most modern-day audiences wouldn't remember him in that way. Parents with children are far more likely to recognize him as a character from Disney's animated film Alice in Wonderland, where he played the stubborn doorknob.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Quite all right, but you did give me quite a turn.
You see, I was following...
Rather good, what? Doorknob turn?
Please, sir.
Well, one good turn deserves another. What can I do for you?
I simply must get through.
Sorry, you're much too big. Simply impassable.
You mean impossible?
No, impassable. Nothing's impossible.
Wow.
That's a big difference.
Yeah, no kidding.
Now, radio actors are... generally aren't people that you would recognize walking down the street because you never actually see them in real life. But if you watched TV in the late 80s and early or late 50s and early 60s, you're probably very familiar with what Joseph Kearns actually looks like, because one of his most famous characters is the last character he ever played, Mr. Wilson on Dennis the Menace.
Mr. Wilson, would you mind giving Sam a home in the fish pond in your backyard?
Yes, I would mind very much.
Then I've got to find him a nice home.
I have no intention of letting a loud bullfrog croak love songs underneath my bedroom window all night long.
Oh, Mr. Wilson, he doesn't even know any.
Doesn't know. Dennis, the answer is no. Now, please take your slimy friend away from here.
The Ultimate Crabby Neighbor. I remember that show well.
Oh, yes. It's quite different from where we started, though, with him as the Man in Black.
Not sinister, but crabby.
Yes. Let's move on to another sinister host, shall we?
Okay.
The show The Mysterious Traveler debuted on the Mutual Network in 1943 with Maurice Tarplin in the title role as the Mysterious Traveler. As he played the dark stranger host who was always riding a train playing creepy stories.
This is the Mysterious Traveler, inviting you to join him on another journey into the realm of the strange and terrifying. I hope you will enjoy the trip, that it will thrill you a little and chill you a little. So settle back, get a good grip on your nerves. Where are we going? We're going to journey to the grave and learn the secrets of the dead.
Always kind of a weird device, I thought. What kind of a person would sit on a train and be like, oh, hello, Marcy. Let me tell you a terrifying story.
He sounds a whole lot like Vincent Price.
He does.
So there must be something about that.
And Vincent Price did his own kind of sinister host at one point. That show ran until 1952, and Maurice Tarplin was very well known for playing that character. But it wasn't all that he did in radio. There was another popular show that was on the air at that same time called Boston Blackie. Boston was a detective, and like all good detectives, he had a police inspector that would just love to pin a rap on him that's chasing him around. When he wasn't playing the Mysterious Traveler, Maurice Tarplin also played Inspector Faraday.
Hello, Blackie.
Why, Faraday? What an unpleasant surprise.
Can't you ever be serious? All right, Blackie. I'll come right to the point.
Mind if I sit down? Not on the point, of course.
Do what you want. Only listen.
Go ahead. I haven't been to a dull lecture in years.
That's cool.
Yeah. He was also on a soap opera at that time. This was a busy man. Long before Guiding Light was a television program, it was a radio show, and Tarplin played District Attorney Richard Hanley.
Hello? No, this is Hanley. Yes, you can see her anytime you want, Brandon. I think we'll be ready to go before the grand jury by the end of the week. All right, Brandon. Goodbye.
Yeah.
I like that.
Quite a range.
Yeah. Well, talented actors, that's what they're supposed to be able to do.
Well, and to be honest, most radio actors at this time period...
Had a lot of jobs
going on at once.
But okay.
Not always a lot of prominent jobs, which Maurice Tarplin had. Let's do one more, shall we, before we end? It's my favorite sinister host of all of them. His name is Raymond, and he's from Inner Sanctum Mysteries.
Good evening, friends of the Inner Sanctum. This is your host, Raymond, inviting you through the squeaking door for a grisly little party.
Now, that's what I like, when you say amusing things instead of scary ones.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, they have a very amusing time in the other world. The other day, they held a masquerade ball, and everyone came disguised as people.
Did they serve refreshments?
Oh, yes, they served Lipton tea. Everybody loved it. Why, to count all the cups of tea they drank, you'd have to be a teetotaler.
Oh, so Lipton tea, the sponsor of that show?
Oh, of course. And that was the pitch woman, Mary. They do a lot of interactions together. Raymond was played by Raymond Edward Johnson, hence the name Raymond. He took his own name when he just created that character.
Funny.
He was a radio and a stage actor, and he was hired to play Raymond in 1941. It was by far his most famous role in radio. He was also, by the way, on Guiding Light with Maurice Tarplin. And he had a working relationship with the well-known writer-director Arch Obler. Raymond Johnson starred in Arch Obler's most popular episode, as a matter of fact, titled The Ugliest Man in the World. It was rebroadcast 5 times because people loved it so much.
Forget me, I tell you. You knew me in the dark. Well, now it's light for you, and I'm not meant for the light. Forget me.
I want to know you in the light, your ugliness.
But you don't know.
I love you.
You don't know.
But I will know. Turn on the light.
I love you. I love you.
But you will know. Turn on the light. Raymond Edward Johnson got a diagnosis later in his life of MS, which ended his stage career. He was a prominent stage actor, and it definitely limited what happened to him from there on out. But he did live until the age of 90, and he was a regular attending Golden Age radio conventions across the country, reprising that role of Raymond for all of his fans.
Now, this is our last live radio retrospective,
yes.
Katie, but it won't. You'll be reprising it, won't you?
I will.
Katie's going off to Rome with her husband, a Roman holiday for 9 months fellowship, and Weekday will be in best of mode for the next 2 weeks. We are starting a new show September 3rd. But a lot of your regular features and friends will be back with you. You're going to hear John Talton. You're going to hear biotech writer Luke Timmerman. We're going to
Vaughn Palmer,
Nancy Pearl, and the Friday News and Review panel stays where it is, 10 a.m. on Friday. But Radio Retrospective?
Radio Retrospective is going to be once a month. It's going to be a little bit shorter, and I'll be filing it from Rome.
Oh, so are you going to start listening to Italian radio shows?
Well, who knows? You never know. But you know me. I just can't stay out of the Golden Age. So even if I'm in a beautiful, eternal city, I'll still be going through the archives of this stuff.
Well, arrivederci, Katie.
Thank you very much.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Well, on Thursdays, we check in with food writer Sarah Dickerman for my point of view, well-needed culinary advice. And Sarah is in the studio. Let's talk about somebody else doing the cooking before I complain about what to do with my pickling cucumbers.
That sounds great. Although there were cucumbers on one of the sandwiches, which led me into this whole issue. I was going to recommend a place it's the Blind Pig Bistro at East Lake Teriyaki. Now, the Blind Pig Bistro has gone into it. It took over the space that was originally where Sitka and Spruce was,
right?
Which is in a little mini mall. It's not very glamorous setting. And it's a lovely little bistro. And then next door there was a teriyaki shop, and they decided, well, why not take that over too when the lease came up? And they are doing terrific little sandwiches.
Wow.
They really didn't change the environment at all.
So this is sort of on the – I've been by it many times. It's in the heart – I think it's on Lynn and mm-hmm. East Lake, mm-hmm. and it's a tiny strip mall.
Yeah.
And unless you knew where Sitka and Spruce was, you would drive right by this place.
Right. And it was – there's a convenience store there. There's a parking lot on top. I mean, it just really kind of blends in. And then they painted – it's bright red now, and it's very simple. And they still have the menu that's, with the little – letters that you push, the plastic letters you push into the ridge back.
Perfect.
But they do really yummy little sandwiches on Macrina potato rolls.
Mm.
They do some banh mi inspired stuff with delicious pickly daikon and cilantro and pork belly, or they do a vegetarian version that's great with a fried egg and yummy mushrooms on the sandwich. Really texturally interesting. And then they did a great little falafel sandwich. Instead of doing balls of falafel, they make kind of a patty,
mm-hmm.
and then they topped it with some delicious little pickled cucumbers.
I'm
lightly pickled.
You're making me very hungry. You've also written about quinoa salad with heirloom tomatoes and crunchy fried chickpeas. So, how would you define this cuisine?
I mean, it's really picking from a little bit of everything. I wouldn't say that. It's very willfully grabbing from whatever culture is exciting taste-wise. And so it can be a little tricky to put together like a meal that kind of all coheres. But I for some reason at lunch, it felt like fun. It's pick and choose what you like. And everything has a very underlying freshness to it, a brightness, lots of lemon, lots of herbs. So you have this really fresh flavor that actually unites all those different flavors.
Yum, yum, yum. You are making me terribly hungry. But I think that all this ecumenicism in cooking has inspired you to bring in a cookbook by sort of like the new American king of of ecumenical mixing.
Right. His name is David Chang. He's very willfully mixes flavors from different cultures and never claims to be an authentic cook. He would rail probably against the concept of authenticity. And, you know, a lot of his food has an Asian inspired base. He actually worked as, in addition to working some very fine New York City French and Italian restaurants, he also did a stint learning how to make soba noodles in Japan.
Well, there has been a series about him on PBS called Mind of a Chef. So uh-huh. I've learned a whole lot more about his wild attitude towards food.
And it's a wild cookbook. It's not carefully paced. It's part memoir. Some of the recipes are just sort of like, I'll show you how to make a pig head torchon, you know, like stuff that, you know, a home cook might not do. But then again, you have the rest, you have the steps to do it if you want to. On the other hand, there are some wonderful little recipes that you can pull out that are so simple and so easy to use, and including a whole great little chapter on pickling.
On pickling? And so are you're telling me pickling is simple?
Some versions of it are. They do a lot of quick pickles, which is just, you know, really salt and sugar on something like a cucumber or a daikon. Leave it to sit for half an hour, and then you've got a quick little pickle that you can put on a sandwich. Will give it crunch and snap. And then he has some vinegar pickles, and then he has some fermented pickles, which, again, it's pretty simple. It just takes time.
Is there a difference between a fermented pickle and kimchi?
Not much, no.
Really? So the idea is just that you're taking a vegetable and you're putting it in something. You're salting it.
Which draws out the liquid. And then there's lactobacillus, the same thing you'd find in yogurt. A slight, maybe a different variation, but basically the same thing. And that it exists on the outside of the vegetable. And in that salty environment, will grow and sour the vegetable over the weeks.
I think I'm going to have to read the cookbook, by the way. I'm not sure we ever said the name. It's Momofuku. And when I say that, those of you who've heard of restaurants probably heard of Momofuku in New York,
right.
And there's Momofuku Milk Bar, and his pastry chefs are the people who are mixing things like coffee grounds
and
cereal.
Into
their whatever, haute cuisine, mid cuisine.
Right.
Punk street cuisine.
Yeah, there's definitely a punk rock appeal. There's a lot of fun. It's a lively book to read. It's sort of fun to look at and read in addition to having some really fun recipes to use.
So go to Blind Pig Bistro on East Lake.
At East Lake Teriyaki.
Okay. At East Lake.
For lunch. They're not open for, the official restaurant's not open for lunch.
Okay. To add East Lake Teriyaki, and then you can go home and try to figure out how to make some of the food, or at least read David Chang. And Sarah Dickerman, it's great to have you in the studio. The next we visit with Sarah, we're going to be in her studio, which is her kitchen. So looking forward to that visit.
Oh, look forward to it too.
Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Alsadi, Andy Hirsch. Jack Walters has been the man at the helm of a pretty wild show today. So thanks for that. And I'm Marcy Silman. Tomorrow, the Week in Review, Eli Sanders back after a long hiatus in Montana. And we're going to visit the Weekday Warehouse with Katie Sewell and Steve Scherr, I think, looking back at 20 years, coming up tomorrow.
...94.9 KUOW News and Information. I'm Jack Walters. Good morning.
Say you're a company that wants a brand new website domain, or me, and you want to buy .O'Leary. It could cost you a pretty penny, $200,000, in fact.
We have to protect that if people do buy a fadi.o'Leary, that in a year, O'Leary will be around to service that website.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, the world of new, pricey domain names, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Listen for that tonight at 6:30 on KUOW 94.9.
I'm Steve Scherr. Starting September 3rd, you'll hear Ross Reynolds, Marcy Silman, and me on the record. We're tracking local, national, and international news and culture.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.